This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanksgiving week and a break from classes allows high school seniors a little bit of time to tackle that major task looming over them, college applications. It may also be a time for families to continue that sticky discussion about what kind of higher education is going to be the best fit and how to pay for it. Earlier this year, President Obama announced his desire to create a new tool for students and their families, a rating system for colleges and universities that assesses value. In an August speech at the University of Buffalo, the president laid out his goals.
Today, I'm proposing major new reforms that will shake up the current system, create better incentives for colleges to do more with less, and deliver better value for students and their families. We're going to be partnering with colleges to do more to keep costs down, and we're going to work with states to make higher education a higher priority in their budgets. And one last thing, we're going to have to ask more of students who are receiving federal aid as well. And I've got to tell you ahead of time, these reforms won't be popular with everybody, especially those who are making out just fine under the current system. But my main concern is not with those institutions. My main concern is the students those institutions are there to serve, because this country is only going to be as strong as our next generation. And I've got confidence. I have confidence that our country's colleges and universities will step up.
Now, the president's plan uses the following criteria: access, the percentage of students receiving Pell Grants, affordability, average tuition, scholarships, and loan debt, and a third criteria, outcomes, graduation and transfer rates, graduate earnings, and advanced degrees of college graduates. Today on this program, we're going to talk with several local colleges and universities to see what they think of this idea of a value ranking and how they assess value on their own campuses. And listeners, we'd love to hear from you as well. Were you already looking at those areas, access, affordability, and outcomes, when you looked at where to go to college or where your children are going to go to college? Or are there other things that are more important? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined now by Greg Buckles, Dean of Admissions at Middlebury College. Greg, nice to talk with you.
Thank you for having me on the show, Jane.
Sue Wertheimer is Vermont Admissions Coordinator at the University of Vermont. She works with in-state student admissions, so it's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Jane.
And Paul Sundy is Director of Admissions at Dartmouth College and joins us from a studio at Dartmouth. Paul, nice to have you on the program.
Pleasure to be here, Jane. Thanks for the invite.
Let's dive right in. You know, the president's plan, we just heard a little bit from the president himself on why he wants to create this value rating system. He would rate the colleges on the criteria that I mentioned and maybe some other ones that are yet to be determined. And then it would eventually tie federal financial aid to the rankings so that students at high-performing institutions would have access to larger Pell Grants and to cheaper loans. Greg Buckles, let me start with you. Does that have you worried? Is that the right way to go, to tie federal loans to the ratings that these schools get?
Well, not particularly, Jane. I think the value proposition has been one that it's been the forefront of, at least throughout my career in 30 years at liberal arts colleges, and it's certainly the case at Middlebury as well. And I think it's been particularly acute since 2008, but we spend a lot of time and have been on the notion of value, particularly as it concerns liberal arts colleges in our case. We have yet to see what the actual plan is and the details. It's one more set of data, one more report to fill out and file in one sense, but we'll certainly comply with any and all federal regulations. And, you know, accountability is not a bad thing. We welcome that. We feel we'll be in a good position as far as Middlebury goes.
Well, you know, anybody who has to comply with federal guidelines would say accountability is a good thing. Does that mean that at Middlebury you think this rating system is a good idea, though, or are you saying not so sure?
Well, given our druthers, I'm not sure. You know, this has been the case as long as I've been in this profession as well, too. We're not making widgets. It's not manufacturing. It's people. It's, in our case, young folks. And that doesn't always translate quite as well into exact outcomes. But some degree of scrutiny is a good thing. We welcome it, sure.
Sue Wertheimer, what about you and UVM?
Well, I would agree with Greg. I think that higher education should be accountable and transparent. We fully support that. We already belong to the voluntary system of accountability, which is a group of about 300 public colleges and universities. And if you want to see what UVM looks like on that, go onto our website, click admissions, and you'll see College Portrait, which gives a lot of this information. We certainly applaud the president for bringing these issues to the forefront. As Greg said, we're interested to see what the details are at the end of the day.
For UVM, one of the questions is always about that affordability piece, and especially for in-state students who are looking at what looks like a high tuition cost compared to what students in some other states pay for in-state tuition.
I think we have a good story to tell there, actually. About a third of our students will graduate, a little over a third of our students graduate without any debt. We are
all students or in-state are we
in-state
talking?
Only, yeah. And we are able to support any of our Pell recipients in Vermont with full tuition covered by grant aid, gift and grant aid. So even though our bottom line is high, I think if you went on to College Portrait, you'd find that we compare very well against some of the flagship publics.
So you're not worried about the president's affordability criteria that would look at average tuition, scholarships, and loan debt?
I think once we factor in the debt and the scholarships and financial aid, I think we will come off looking quite positive.
Paul Sundy, what about Dartmouth? What's Dartmouth's stance on this idea of a Department of Education-sponsored rating system?
Well, I think the issue of value is a term that holds different meaning for different people. And so I think the overall concept is one that makes sense, and I would echo the comments of my colleagues. But I think we have a ways to go before we determine those details. And I think some of the responses that the government has received on its listening tour are an indication of that.
So, Paul, for Dartmouth students, you know, and from your perspective, do you think federal aid should be tied to the schools in the way the president is proposing, or does that punish students rather than making universities and colleges more responsible?
Well, the notion of an outcomes-based measure, I think, makes sense. And I think the idea of the government saying we spend tens of billions of dollars on higher education and we'd like to know what we're getting for that, I think that makes sense.
Greg Buckles, is value something that can be rated based on the criteria the president lists? I mean, it's not in there things like extracurriculars or good teaching. Is it all about jobs and debt loads when it comes to value?
Well, certainly not. We feel and talk to young students and their families about a lot of things when we talk about college, and I'm sure as my colleagues at their respective institutions feel similarly. We often tell young people that probably the most important factor in determining what their experience is like in college, at least at a residential liberal arts college like Middlebury, has to do with relationships and people, and there certainly is no criteria for measuring that, I would anticipate. But in as much as people need data, people need facts, and they want information on graduation rates and debt and what students are doing with those degrees, that's information we're happy to provide in any event. So those are important factors. And again, it's readily available right now at Middlebury, and we're always happy to share that.
What is the average debt load of a Middlebury student graduating with?
It does depend when it comes out, but right now, as I like to point out, it's less than what I graduated in debt with in 1984, typically. But it's on average about $3,000 a year at max to maybe about four. So it would typically be $12,000 or less, depending on the package.
So, Wertheimer, what about other things that might be of value to students and families and to the university itself that aren't necessarily going to be listed in a values rating system?
Well, we would probably want to add something about the student experience. There's a survey called the National Survey of Student Engagement, or NESE, as we call it. We're good on acronyms in higher education. And that does get at some of the significant experiences that students report having at their institutions. And that would help round out, I think, some of the information that the president is suggesting that we collect and present.
And I understand that Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, is going around and doing these sort of listening tour things to try to figure out what should be in this rating system. Is UVM talking with the
UVM will be preparing a written brief. None of the open forum were held very close to the university, but we have been invited to present written information, and we will be doing that.
We're talking today about how to assess value when it comes to higher education. Schools themselves have some ideas. Parents have ideas. Students may have other ones. And listeners, if you are any of those types of people, we'd love to hear from you. What do you think is the value of a higher education, and how do we actually get to that in a rating system? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We have a lot of people there commenting already. And we asked, what do you think the value should be? How do you determine that? Blythe says the number of employed graduates who are using their degrees would be a good criteria. Marianne says the initial starting salary or average first five-year earnings post-graduation compared to the cost of the school. But Tim says, don't worry about lists. Go where you'd be most happy. I was accepted at multiple private schools, but I picked a tiny state college, and I couldn't have been happier, he says. And let's go to Joyce Judy, who's calling in now. She's the president of the Community College of Vermont, which is in the state college system. President Judy, nice to talk with you. You on the line with us yet?
My call.
Oh, there you go. We got you.
Okay.
So what do you think about this idea of a value rating system, and how do you think it would affect CCV?
Well, first of all, I agree with all three of your participants in that I think accountability is a really good thing, and I think that colleges should be held accountable to the public and making sure that people know what they're getting. But I think one of the things that I would want to comment on around the new federal scorecard and the ratings is that it's so focused on a very traditional student population, the student who graduates from high school and enrolls in a college full-time that following September. And so it doesn't take into account a part-time student or a student who starts in one school and transfers to another school. It really looks at a cohort of what they call first-time, full-time students. And for the majority of students who are enrolled in colleges throughout the country, that's not the typical path anymore. It's really about part-time students stopping and starting, and students who transfer. And I'll give you an example. CCV, when we look at our graduation rate, it is figured on a population of first-time, full-time students. This fall, we had less than 100 students who started first-time, full-time in college, and yet we had 2,000 new students. So it really doesn't... The metrics that they're working on right now are really challenging to, they don't give the picture of what a community college or a college that serves a lot of part-time students, it just doesn't paint a very accurate picture. So I would just say that, you know, in terms of thinking around the federal scorecard and the new rating system, well, I applaud, I think we should be held accountable, and I think we should be able to share our information with the public. I'd want to make sure that when we're designing it, that we really have the diverse student population in mind.
We got a note from Jim, Joyce, who says, you know, if you analyze Castleton, Linden, and Johnson State College, only 16% of their students graduate within 4 years. Those colleges gladly accept the students' tuition, but they don't give adequate support to our young students. Does the fault rest with these colleges, or does the fault rest with our public high schools? So along the same lines of what you're talking about, President Judy, in that not everybody is graduating within a four-year, or at CCV's case, a two-year timetable. You know, there are a lot of different ways of graduating, but Jim thinks that there's not enough support in the state college system.
I think what I would challenge us to think about is what how we measure graduation rates, because it's on a very tiny little cohort of people who start in college as a first-time, full-time student. And for colleges that serve a population that is very diverse, and, you know, when you think about that graduation rate, it's of the students who started and went to school straight full-time for 4 years, that's how they figure the graduation rate at the three schools he just mentioned, and for CCV the same way. And many students don't even if they started full-time, they might take a semester off, they might drop down to half-time, they might work a semester, they might transfer. CCV has a significant number of students who transfer to the University of Vermont, transfer to another Vermont State College, and those students are completely lost in anybody's metric, and yet they're truly a success story.
So in other words, the fact that people don't necessarily graduate within 2 years or 4 years or even 6 years, which is sometimes used as criteria, doesn't necessarily detract from the value of a school, is what you're saying.
That's correct. And I would also say that when, you know, students come into a school in all different entry points, you know, they might transfer into a school with 6 credits that they accumulated from somewhere and then graduate from that school. But if they transfer in with credits, they're not even factored into a college's graduation rate.
That's Joyce Judy. She's the president of CCV, the Community College of Vermont. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us. Appreciate it on this discussion.
Thank you, Jane.
Let's
Bye-bye.
Go to Jay, who's calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Jay. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. I was trying to reconcile the comment by the president of Middlebury that the average loan is $3,000 to $4,000 a year to what I see as the sticker price of about $50,000 a year. I have a son who is going to be in college soon, and I am hesitant to even apply to colleges where the tuition is $50,000 a year. But how does that reconcile with average loans of only $3,000 to $4,000? It's just wealthy parents sending kids there, or how does this work?
Jay, thanks for your call. Greg Abakles, I'll go to you first on this because he's talking about what you said. I think you said the debt load was $3,000 a year, not the loan, right?
That's correct, and I'm also pleased to have earned a promotion, apparently, in the last hour to president. someone needs to tell Ron that. In any event, no, that's correct, that at $57,000, just over $57,000 a year this year, we are a need-blind institution, and that means that decisions regarding candidates are made without any regard to ability to pay. And in this past year's freshman class, first-year class, 45% of the incoming students receive financial aid. The vast majority of that financial aid is grant or money that does not need to be repaid that is provided by Middlebury College. So when students do take and typically there is a small amount of loan involved, and that would typically over 4 years equal roughly $12,000 or less or slightly more depending on the individual package. So that $3,000 to $4,000 a year is part of an average grant package, an average financial aid package at Middlebury is just over $36,000 a year. So the vast majority of that is grant money that a family does not repay.
Nonetheless, at schools like Middlebury College and like Dartmouth, Paul Sundy, there is this assumption that you have to be rich to go there.
Yes, that's an unfortunate assumption from our perspective. Dartmouth is another one of the institutions which is need blind and full funding in its financial aid policies. And one of my chief concerns for students is that they look at our sticker price and think this is unattainable. If they were to do our calculator and spend some time looking into the financial aid opportunities, I think they would be, many of the students who haven't thought to do that would be pleasantly surprised by the financial opportunity that they would have here.
We're talking today again about how to assess value when it comes to higher education. A lot of new rankings coming out that try to get at this, try to figure out a value of a college beyond the teaching, beyond the amenities that a school provides. What are students going to get out of it? And a lot of that does come down to a calculation between how much the school costs versus how much there is in loans and grants on average, and then looking as well at what kind of jobs are students getting after graduation. So we're taking all of this into account. We're talking with some admissions officers at local colleges and universities about how they see value. And we're hearing from many of you. You can let us know your criteria. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're looking at how to assess value when it comes to higher education. President Obama wants to have a value rating system to make it easier for families to assess not only what it's going to cost them, but to have a tangible sense of what a student is likely to get out of school in the end. But some admissions officers worry that some of the intangibles will get lost in this kind of system. We're talking with Middlebury College Dean of Admissions Greg Buckles, UVM Vermont Admissions Coordinator Sue Wertheimer, and Dartmouth Director of Admissions Paul Sundy. And listeners, you can share your thoughts at vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, or give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. And let's go to Louisa, who's calling in from Brandon. Hi, Louisa. Go ahead.
Hi. So I am a student right now. Well, actually, I'm taking a gap year. and I'm going to attend UVM next year. But I was just going to mention how I believe that Obama's plan would have really helped me last year when I was looking at schools. I looked at 17 different schools, and I in the back of my head, I'm just like, I'm not going to go to UVM. But ironically, in the end, I am going to UVM, and I personally feel like I made the best choice, and I'm going to have a good balance of education and, like, the being a Vermonter, just the atmosphere that I'd like. So.
Well, Louisa, first of all, congratulations on getting in and on going to college. Sounds great. But when you say it would have helped you to have a value ranking system, if you looked at 17 schools, how did you try to figure out what was going to be the best fit for you sort of culturally as well as financially?
Well, I looked at all schools in the Northeast because, I mean, I'm a very outdoorsy person and I wanted to still be, like, near woods. And I honestly, I'm the eldest child and I had no idea. And I love doing everything and trying new things. And so I looked from, like, huge campuses from, like, UMass Amherst, to, like, Middlebury, Bowdoin, so, like, everything in between. So I honestly don't know.
Well, congratulations again, Louise. I hope this is a great gap year. And I know Sue Wertheimer was cheering when you said you were going to UVM. So she'll see you there next year. We got a note from Gina who says, I am a high school senior from Montpelier, Vermont. Coming from a middle-class Vermont family, cost has been a top priority in the college decision process. I believe that reviewing the financial success of graduates 10 to 15 years after graduation is important data to collect. Considering the high cost of college these days, many people, including me, believe that the greatest value in higher education is its ability to serve as a platform to send students into today's competitive career environment. Colleges need to get students out in the field during their undergraduate studies to give them a leg up in job competition. And let's go to Dave calling in from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Dave. Your thoughts?
Well, I am a person who voted for Obama twice, and I don't want another federal program. I think that something remotely like the U.S. News and World Report college evaluation that they do, I think, every year, is a far better way, and it doesn't involve any tax dollars. I'd also like to give a shout out to Middlebury. My son went there, and essentially they paid for his college education. We didn't have very much money at the time, and it wound up being far cheaper than UVM, for instance, would have been for us. And he graduated at the top of his class, which pleased me.
Yes, I'm sure it did. Dave, thanks very much for your call. Appreciate that. Lots of different perspectives here. Sue Wertheimer, I want to go to you first for your thoughts.
Well, I am thrilled that Louise is going to UVM. She did what I think a good potential college student should do. She visited a lot of campuses. We're very fortunate in Vermont that we have so many different types of institutions so close by, so that's a possibility. There was a student, somebody who wrote in saying that experience is part of the proposition in colleges, and we're very proud of our new career and experience hub that will ensure that every student has a career plan where they can go one-stop shopping in our Davis Center for internships, research opportunities, jobs, career advising. So I think we're moving forward at UVM on that sphere. The dad whose son in St. Johnsbury paid less to go to Middlebury. Congratulations, you did your homework. We would have loved to have seen your son at UVM, but am glad that everything worked out for you. And we know those stories are possible. Paul mentioned a moment ago the calculator. We all are required to have a net price calculator on our websites. You'll find ours on our Student Financial Services site. And that's a good way to estimate what a particular college or school may actually cost you, and not to be afraid of the bottom line cost. Take a look at the calculators.
Paul Sundy, that is one of the parts that I think is so hard for parents too, and for students as they're applying and then as they're getting acceptance letters back and financial aid packages, is trying to figure out that bottom line and trying to figure out what school is going to be the best fit, and then having to wait to see what kind of financial aid package you get, because as we've heard, sometimes you may be accepted in two places, but the cost is going to be different based on what the financial aid package looks like. I mean, that's so difficult for families to try to calculate in while they're figuring out all of this other stuff.
I agree 100%, Jane. One of the things that I think about this process is that very often students don't attend their first choice college. They attend their first choice financial aid package. The reality is that I think cost is a far greater concern, even in, among very selective institutions, than will I get in? Can I afford to pay? And I think that there's another underlying point to what we're hearing today, which is this is incredibly complicated. And there isn't just one list. There are many lists. We have a scorecard right now from the White House. We have the U.S. News and World Report list. We have myriad other lists from many other publications, and each is trying to get at this issue. And I think that as families sort through things, understanding what is it that we feel is a legitimate cost for us? What can we afford for our child's education? I think that's a critical element. But also a critical element is how do I perceive value? What matters to me in this process? And you've relayed a number of elements that folks value, and those are all valid. And I think many other families might have other things to add to that list. So understanding what can you afford, what do you value most, and then seeking those sources of information where you can find that. Perhaps it begins with a list. Perhaps it begins with several lists and then it moves on to college websites and so forth. But my one concern about lists is the tendency to potentially oversimplify, that if something's just high on this list, well, we're good to go. I think there's much more detail that needs to be plumbed, and it is incredibly time-consuming.
We got a note from Ed who says, the fortune cookie says, knowledge will give you a job, wisdom will give you a life. Quantifying the rewards of a good liberal education makes no sense. And let's hear from Doug in Cambridge. Hi, Doug. Go ahead.
Hi there. I wanted to, actually, I think I'm agreeing with a lot of what's being said here with what adds value into our educational system. When I chose Lyndon State College for my undergraduate, one of the biggest factors for me was that it had an ambulance squad. That was a part of my life prior to my going to college. And there's not going to be a system, especially a federal system, and as your last speaker was saying about oversimplifying things, that's going to be able to address the unique aspects of college and encourage colleges to develop unique programs, because they're not going to be defined on a federal scorecard. And my correlated concern is that eventually this oversimplification is going to be used as a basis for award for financial aid by institutions. Well, this is a school with high value, and we're going to add to that or give more money to that school, and it's actually going to push the market artificially. I think that there's a beholden responsibility on students to do some research and actually have to, great scorecards and different aspects of looking at things, but I don't think the federal government's the place to do it. I think they should take care of federal business, and students need to do some research to find out what's going to be best for their lives.
Yeah, Doug, thanks for that thought. Appreciate it. Let's hear from Paul, who's on the line with us from South Burlington. Hi, Paul. Your thoughts on this?
Yes. My stepson went to South Burlington High School, and after his freshman year, he knew what college he wanted to go to, and he knew what was necessary to get there. And they didn't prepare him for that. There were two courses he absolutely needed, and he tried to get them. And South Burlington just didn't, I suspect, and this is a suspicion on my part, didn't think he was college material. But he's now a junior in that college and will graduate next year and go on to a very successful career that he planned for.
Well, Paul, I appreciate your thoughts, and you bring up a good point, which is, of course, it's one thing to have this value rating system and to think about what college you want to go to, but, beyond the scope of this program today is how we get students prepared to go to those schools and to be as prepared as they need to be to get into the schools that they want to go to. Really good point, and we've talked about that in some other shows. We'll try to put links to those at vpr.net because it is a crucial piece of this puzzle. I want to ask, at the beginning of the show, we heard President Obama saying schools are going to have to make do with less. They're going to have to do more with less. And Greg Buckles, I'd love to know what you think, because I look at all three of your campuses And if we're talking about the physical plant, it doesn't look like any of you are making do with less. I mean, it seems like you have beautiful campuses and more buildings, better buildings coming up all the time. You know, you can drive by and see the new athletic facility going up at Middlebury College. So what do you take that to mean? And does it mean that you should scale back some of those other amenities that are appealing to students and to families in order to get at the value?
Well, I certainly would agree with all that. We have to demonstrate accountability and responsibility fiscally as an academic institution. And one of the interesting things that this focus on value has forced us and many others to do is to think about direct action. One good example at Middlebury post-2008 was our initiative that our president, President Leibowitz, announced for CPI plus one tuition rate increase. So currently, Middlebury, in order to determine its tuition annually, ties that directly to the consumer price index plus one percentage point. And that's something that in the past probably wasn't necessary. We might not have thought about or discussed, but as the debate about value moves forward, I think, permitted and in some way forced colleges to come up with creative and responsible ways to demonstrate that fiscal accountability.
So, Wertheimer, is that something that's happening at UVM? You look at these lists and say, okay, maybe value we need to recalculate.
Well, I don't know that the lists are causing that. I think the university is always undergoing a process of looking at what it does well, looking at what it needs to do in the future. The new STEM proposal is the science, technology, engineering, and math. Improvements to create some 21st century classroom is one of those. But we are always assessing, regardless of whether something is on a list or not.
Paul Sundy, last couple of seconds from you on thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think at Dartmouth our concern is driven by outcomes and how are our students faring. And we're constantly thinking about innovating and improving our student experience with a focus on outcome. And in terms of investment, we're always going to be wise and prudent to make sure that whatever dollar we spend on whatever facility or program is geared towards meeting our mission.
That's Paul Sundy, Director of Admissions at Dartmouth College. Paul, thanks to you and thanks to Dartmouth for the studio today. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Greg Buckles is Dean of Admissions at Middlebury College. Thanks to Middlebury for their studio today. Greg, nice to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on the program, Jane.
And Sue Wertheimer is Vermont Admissions Coordinator at the University of Vermont. She works with in-state student admissions, and she was here in our studio. Sue, nice to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up, a chance encounter led two local musicians to a family connection and a fruitful musical collaboration. We'll talk with Christina Stikos and her cousin Steve Mayone next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This time of year is often a chance for family to come together. For two musicians in our region, their family connections came as a bit of a surprise. Christina Stikos is a singer, songwriter, and music producer who lives in the tiny town of Washington, Vermont. Her cousin, Steve Mayone, lives near Boston, but plays and sings in Vermont fairly often. The two didn't know each other until a chance encounter at a concert. But once the familial connection was established, they formed a musical collaboration. Last week, I talked with Stikos about her solo album, Wyoming Territory, and her collaboration with Mayone on The Cousins Project.
What you said is what you've done. If I drew the wrong conclusion, may God bring me gently down and humor my confusion.
Christina, it's a pleasure to have you on Vermont Edition.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You have been in this industry for many, many years. How did you get your start?
Oh, golly. Well, I started as a musician. So I've been doing that ever since I was knee high. I was thinking back about it. I think the first time I did my own recording was back in the 80s when I was living in Hanksville in a farmhouse. And I had my first Fostex 4-track tape machine. And I spent one long winter trying to figure out all those dials and knobs and started recording myself and figuring out how to do different parts and multi-tracking. And so I had an interest in it even back then.
How old were you then?
Oh, gosh, I was in my 20s, 25 maybe.
So is it a different scene to be a recording artist and a musician, singer, songwriter, performer in Vermont? Well, obviously it's a different scene than being in New York. But what do you think that means to be a singer-songwriter here now?
Well, I think one of the reasons that we live here as musicians is that we don't want to really be in that competitive environment. I know that's true for me. I'm really just more concerned in figuring out what I have to say and how to say it, how I want to say it without a lot of external influences. I mean, the downside is that if you like to perform, there's a lot less opportunities up here. So, you know, it's hard to get good at performing in Vermont, but, you know, you can do almost everything else up here.
Well, you'd think maybe then Vermont is a rural enough place, but you decided to take it even further and go even more rural. Not that long ago, you went to Wyoming, and it helped inspire a new album, Wyoming Territory.
That's right. And that was really because I made some connections in Montana 3 or 4 years ago with a pianist out there, Phil Auberg. And then I was invited to go out to an artist residency in Wyoming, and so I kind of jumped at the chance.
Do you think that album is different than if you had done it here?
Yeah, well, it had to do as a combination of it being in the West and also it being an artist residency, where basically they set you up for a month in a private space where you can just focus on writing, and they feed you. So you don't have to think about anything. You just show up at 6 o'clock for dinner. They give you these amazing meals, and then you go back to your studio and you can work till 2 in the morning and just completely own your experience. So that was key for me to have that opportunity. It was the first time I'd ever done anything like that.
Well, let's hear one of the songs from the album. Which one do you want to play?
Well, let's see. Track number one called Watershed. This is a song that I actually started years ago, and I couldn't seem to get it to the finish line. When I got back from Wyoming, suddenly the choruses appeared to me, and the whole thing took on a new life. Me on playing various guitars, but there's other musicians and featured doing this fiddle solo is Patrick Ross, who I think a lot of people know around here. He's a fantastic fiddle player.
You were saddling the horses on that brisk November day. I can still remember how you saw me and turned away. Oh, my love, is it so? Could it be you'd leave me in this prison? Can't you see my youth is gone? Please, darling, change your cruel decision.
In addition to recording your own songs, you're also a music producer for other artists. What does that entail for you?
Well, people come to me. They walk in, oftentimes with a guitar and some songs. And sometimes they know what they want to do, but I would say most of the time they don't. They just know that they want to get a good recording. And so it's my job to really assess what that would mean for them. Sometimes it's just getting a really fine recording of them playing their instrument and singing. Sometimes it means producing a whole album with lots of other instruments.
I mean, it must be in some ways people are saying, I want to record with you because they know what you're going to bring to the table is going to help them. But it must be difficult not to say, well, here's how I would do it if I were the one performing this song.
Yeah, it is tricky. I mean, usually what I'll do is we'll record their basic tracks and then we'll have a brainstorming session and see what they're hearing. And I'll make a few suggestions. And if they want something that I think I can do, I will say, well, let me take a swing at it and I'll try something. And then I'll give it, you know, hand it back to them and say, what do you think? And from there, we can start a discussion because either they think it's great, it's going in the right direction, or it's all wrong and we have to go back to the starting point again.
You've talked recently a little bit about some difficulty that you're having with vocal control and how that's changed how you sort of think of yourself as a performer and as a singer-songwriter. What's happened to your voice?
Well, about 10 years ago, my voice just started sort of collapsing from what it had been. I used to have sort of a typical soaring alto sort of soprano voice. It was disconcerting. I was just launching into a lot of performing at the time, and I really had to figure out what to do. Luckily, I can say that I really identify mostly with being a writer and an arranger, and the fact that my voice isn't what it used to be is not really cramping my style a lot. So it's all working out for the best. I get to be in the studio and create. And when I do cut a vocal track, I can take time with it and I can sing it a bunch of times until I get it the way I want. And I don't have to be terrified that, you know, people are listening right at that moment. And of course, my wonderful cousin Steve, who we're going to be talking to soon, he has been sort of dragging me back onto the stage as well with the Cousins Project.
We're going to bring Steve into the conversation in just a moment. So let's sort of set up that part of the conversation with a song from the album that you did with him.
Let's do one of the rocky ones here. Deep, Deep Baby is sort of one of my typically existential, angsty kind of songs.
Deep, deep baby, it's the way I feel when I talk but never listen. When I keep running, driving and humming with no sense of what's missing. Oh my word, it's a lonely world when love is only the senses. I'll give you if you give me two, if you can pass my defenses.
That's Deep, Deep Baby. We're talking with Christina Stykos about a couple of new albums that she has out. And we're going to bring in now her cousin, Steve Mayone, because he is involved in this song and the album that we've just been listening to. This is the Cousins Project that they've been working on together. Steve, it's a pleasure to have you on Vermont Edition.
Very happy to be here.
So you two are second cousins, but Christina, you and Steve didn't know each other growing up.
No, we didn't, did we, Steve?
No, we did not. No, we live in the same state, but we met in 2006.
Yeah, I feel like I've known you forever, though.
Yeah.
Well, how do you wind up doing a collaborative project with a cousin that you never even knew you had?
Well, you know, we live parallel lives, and she's a very generous, talented woman and records people and offered to record me, like just me playing my tunes. I thought, well, you know, if we're going to work together, let's meet halfway and see what we can do together.
Steve said that, you know, you had led sort of parallel musical lives. How does that then, though, Christina, lead you into saying, let's do an album together? Because, you know, it's one thing to have this connection personally, and it's another thing to professionally put yourselves together.
Well, it sort of led Steve to suggest it. I'm going to give him the credit for it because I was very busy, and I just wasn't sure what was going to transpire with Steve. And he said, okay, why don't we do this? Why don't you go through your folder and see if there's any lyrics that you're not using? And just send them down. It was kind of a casual thing. Just, you know, send them down to me. So I did. And then he came back a few months later and said, well, why don't you listen to this? Because I've put this to music. And when I heard what he was doing, all of a sudden I was like, wow, okay, this is a good way to start. So he jump-started it that way. And then we both got really excited about it.
Well, let's hear another song, one of the ones that Steve leads on.
Okay, Rescue Me. It's track one on Beautiful Blood. Cousins Project.
Oh, I don't expect you to always read my mind. Please don't feel abandoned when I leave this world behind. But there are certain places that you're not allowed. Oh, baby, I still love you.
Steve, Christina said you've been sort of dragging her out to perform since you did this collaboration together. What's that been like performing?
I shouldn't make it sound so negative. I'm sorry, Steve. No. I've had a great time with you.
No, of course. No, it's been fun. It's a good challenge, I think. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm more used to performing than she is, but I have to say, like her, I much more enjoy performing with other singer-songwriters because I get to lay back, they get to lead the show, and I get to just be a part of the energy.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you both on Vermont Edition and a pleasure to hear the music that you've created together. I really appreciate
you
both.
Thank
you. Taking the time.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Is there another song that we should lead out with?
Well, I'd love to hear South of the Chelsea Line because that's a lyric I love of Christina's perfect collaboration because she liked the music and I love the words and we tinkered with it a little bit, but this is a collaborative piece.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for joining us by phone. Appreciate it.
Nice to meet you too. Bye, cousin. I'll call you later.
Okay.
Okay, bye.
He's such a sweetheart.
Windows down and the air is rushing in. South of the Chelsea Rim. Silver rain soaking your skin. How did we make this?
drives this love so strong.
That's Christina Stikos and Steve Mayone. The Long Lost Cousins are also musical collaborators. We heard tracks from Wyoming Territory and The Cousins Project, and you can learn more at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. That's it for today. Tomorrow we'll talk with an expert in workplace culture about what employers can do to improve the wellness of their workers. Healthy, happy employees are better employees, the theory goes, but how can the workplace itself make employees healthier and happier? Stand-up desks, anyone? Share your thoughts by writing to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.